Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest and You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, we conclude our Race for the First series. Over the past few months, we've introduced you to the many candidates running for New Hampshire's first congressional district. Our candidate today is Democrat Paul Cardinal. He's a New Hampshire native. He works for a technology company in Merrimack. And let's hear from you, especially if you live in the first district. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Or, of course, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And you can also watch our interview today on Facebook Live. Paul Cardinal, welcome. Nice to meet you.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Well, as I'm sure you're very aware, there are lots of other people running in this race. You jumped in late after about 9 or 10 other Democrats had been campaigning for months. So what prompted you to do this?
Well, there's certainly a variety of reasons that I was interested in getting involved in the race. I will say that, you know, I waited until the registration period to announce my candidacy. So it's funny, I feel like we live in an environment today where people are campaigning for years on end and 24/7, and I'm fairly obsessed with politics, and even I get a little bit of campaign fatigue. So while the field is large, I was happy to kind of enter for the home stretch. In regards to why I got involved, like I said, there could be a laundry list, but I'll focus on a couple of different issues. The first is that I feel like throughout the 8 elections that I've been old enough to vote in, we've often been given candidates based on factors that don't often relate to the citizenry of the state or even the country. I think that oftentimes we're told who to vote for, who our candidates should be, what type of background they should have. And I'm not a polished politician looking to fit that mold. I think it's about time that we had representatives in Congress who are more representative of the state. And looking at the field, I didn't feel that there were strong candidates doing that, that were finding a way to bring progressive values that we all agree on to a large swath of the state that labels themselves as undeclared rather than just Democrats. I think we have a lot of strong Democratic candidates, but the key to this race is going to be who can bring the 40% into the fold to help us win the general.
Well, let's talk about some of the issues that you've been talking about in your campaign. And again, I want to remind our listeners that you can join us, 1-800-892-6477. So education, your online bio says you work with schools on technology. I think I saw your title as technology evangelist. In your travels to schools, what do you see as the biggest need?
Yeah, there's a lot of needs. I think that oftentimes people look at the educational problems in this country and restricted budgets in local communities and think that maybe we can just throw more money at a problem. I sell folks technology and education, and in that capacity, I'm talking to teachers and educators and educational leaders day in and day out about how to better integrate technology to improve curriculum delivery, to find ways to make the infrastructure more efficient or fit their goals better. But oftentimes it's not specifically, I mean, if you throw enough money at any problem, you can solve it. But I think we really need to revisit in innovative ways the way we deliver education to begin with. Even as somebody who sells technology, there's a lot of statistics that show that even children born after 2010 are still learning better away from technology with textbooks.
I wanted to ask you about that, actually, you know, because some people said there's too much tech in schools, that our kids are tech saturated outside of school enough as it is. So why throw more tech at them in school? Now, obviously, you need some level because you have to learn certain things. But I wonder what you think about that, that kids need a break from screens constantly before their eyes, you know, let their brains work differently.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I think that there's a time and place, right? We don't oversaturate students with too much math because we think there's too much, or too much English and so on and so forth. Technology is the same thing. Like, we don't need to pretend that there's a magic bean that's going to solve the problem. There are certainly ways that technology can help with educational deliverables. And I think that we're still trying to find the mix of what exactly that is. And there's case studies done around the country of schools that have gone full tech, schools that have integrated it in, you know, for advanced programs and what have you. But at the end of the day, it has to be a balance between what's best for educators, what's best for students, what's best for parents. I think I just think that we've had a legacy method of delivering education for a long time in this country, and we really haven't revisited, you know, are we doing this at the best times? Are we doing this with the best sized classrooms? Or are we starting children early enough, which I don't think we are. And I think we really need to revisit the entire process and figure out what the best delivery method is for 2018, not for 1800s when the system was designed.
So I'm listening to you talk and I'm thinking, wow, he's got an expertise in this. He's thought about this. Why not run for school board instead of Congress?
So I spent time actually when I was in high school as a representative to the school board. I certainly am passionate about becoming involved in my local community. I think that school board's perhaps not the best example because it's something that is a little bit easier to balance with the rest of the things that I think regular citizens in the state have going on in their lives. But I think as a whole, our state and local government is a great body with great people doing great work, but oftentimes can disenfranchise people who need to work a full-time job. You know, I work about 50 hours a week and I try and balance my free time between my family and getting involved in the community. But the state and local government jobs in the state are essentially volunteer. You make $100 a term to go in the state house, $200 in the Senate. I think the executive council makes about $12,000 a year. And it's great that we have people in this state that can afford to do things like that, that only need to make $12,000 a year. But I'm not one of them.
Yeah, you've got a family, you've got a young baby, you need to make some money.
Exactly. Okay. And I think a lot of the folks in this state are disenfranchised from not just from running because they feel like they can't afford to run and hold office, but even from voting because they feel that the people who can afford to run and hold those roles aren't really representative of what they believe in because they're in different financial brackets.
Let's talk about some of the other issues in this campaign that we've talked about with other candidates in this Race for the First series. And since we're talking about schools, Paul, let's talk about school safety. Major issue in light of the just heartbreaking shootings we've seen at schools around the country. What solutions would a congressman, Paul Cardinal, put in place?
I think that this is an absolutely traumatizing issue and one that I'm sure all of us had hoped that we'd never have to discuss. It's frightening to me and to my friends with small children to think about how different schools have become from when we were kids to today in just, you know, 20 or 25 short years. We need to look at changes to gun control in this country that 80 to 90% of the country supports.
So give us some specifics there, what you would support.
Waiting periods for weapons. We need background checks for all weapons. We need to get rid of the gun show loopholes. We need to look at the market for firearms that are out there and determine which ones we feel are safe for normal citizens to own, not military-grade items. And, you know, there's a lot of confusion about what an assault rifle is and what isn't, so I don't want to pin it just to assault rifles, but look at weapons that you can attach bump stocks to. Look at large magazine sizes and really scale that stuff down. I think it's pretty easy to say that getting a gun should not be less difficult than getting a driver's license.
There are a lot of folks in New Hampshire who feel guns are not the problem with this school safety issue, that it's more a cultural problem, a mental health problem, a reflection of violence in society, a reflection of family breakdown, that it's too easy to just pin it on the guns. And I wonder what you think about that.
Yeah, I think there are other contributing factors. But if we can look at guns to mitigate part of it, why not? I think we should look to mitigate other issues as well. Like, we have a mental health court program in this state that's grossly underfunded. And I talk to police officers all over the state that feel that the majority of their time is spent dealing with mental health issues, not with criminal issues. So, yeah, we need to find a way to fund better programs for mental health courts in the state and find a way to better address other issues that are contributing to these tragedies. But it'd be naive to say that guns aren't one of the ways we can reduce.
So if you were the Democratic nominee, and that's a tough challenge given how many people there are, but let's say you were, how would you respond to charges in the general election, Mr. Cardinal, that, you know, Paul Cardinal wants to take your guns away?
Well, I think that's a fun narrative for people to say, but we have no elected officials in the history of this country who have really taken any steps to take people's guns away. I will not be another one. I think that there's enough reasonable people in the state of New Hampshire and in the country that find that comment laughable, that know that nobody's coming after their guns. There's no way we could even figure out who has the guns to come after them to begin with. It's not a realistic approach.
Let's talk about a couple other issues that you've been talking about as you campaign. Marijuana, you've called decriminalization the biggest no-brainer in politics, and you've said that legalization could provide income that could be put to greater use. Although legal, as you know, in some states, marijuana remains illegal on the federal level. So as a member of Congress, Mr. Cardinal, would you try to change that, legalize marijuana nationally?
Absolutely. I think that attacking it from a state issue is a good first approach. It's a middle step. But the real issue with marijuana in this country is that it's listed as a Schedule I substance on par with the likes of LSD and cocaine and heroin. Whereas it has far less debilitating effects than not just those drugs, but even alcohol and cigarettes. The state of New Hampshire made, I think, around $64 million in alcohol sales last year in revenue. And further, we're spending an inordinate amount of money policing marijuana offenses in the state and across the country. So providing a revenue stream the way states like Colorado have done that will mirror alcohol in the state while also allowing our law enforcement to no longer focus on criminal issues regarding marijuana are two just, as you mentioned, no-brainer ways to get some more
funding
into
the state. Well, your words there for decriminalization. So if you were a member of Congress, you would promote legalized marijuana nationally, never mind the state-by-state
approach.
And we've talked with many in the addiction treatment field who've said, no, marijuana is not harmless, and that legalizing marijuana is the last thing we should do in the midst of an opioid epidemic. So I wonder what you think about that, that we don't need one more illegal substance for people to alter their minds with.
Well, maybe we should start criminalizing alcohol and cigarettes differently then. I mean, it's easy to, we've been told since Reagan or since the war on drugs that marijuana is a gateway drug to further things. But in reality, the stats don't actually hash that out. More folks use recreational marijuana without ever trying another substance, one drug, than other in the United States.
Let's talk about the opioid crisis a little bit. News just recently that the state is in line to receive a lot more money than it expected, $45 million over a two-year period. So a lot of people are cheering this. What do you think, Mr. Cardinal, is the best use for those funds? If you were in charge of, you know, slicing up the pie, so to speak.
Yeah, I think it's great news. And I think we've had representatives for a few years now who have really, you know, from New Hampshire on a national level, who have focused on getting us that funding. So I commend them for doing so. I'm not an expert on the opioid crisis. So what I've spent my time doing over the past few months is talking to folks who are dealing with it day in and day out. And one of those folks runs the drug court system in the state. And we talked a lot about the issues that folks that are struggling with opioid addiction deal with in regards to being jailed for getting caught with opioids or not being able to find a rehabilitation program when they're arrested. And I think that what the drug courts have done needs to be spread out more with those funds, right? So they're finding ways to keep folks from going to jail for an addiction problem. And the success rate has been much greater. There's 60% less recidivism from people who are going to drug courts rather than going to prison. And I think also we have some great institutions in the state that are approaching this from a rehabilitation standpoint. I do have a lot more to learn about which of those programs deserve more of the funding, and I'll continue to educate myself on it as we go forward.
Well, let's talk about health care. You've said that everyone has a right to quality health care. Does that mean you support the Medicare for All bill that's basically creating a single-payer health care system in this country?
Absolutely. I support Medicare for All on a single-payer method. I think that while I'm a strong supporter of a free market, perhaps more so than many Democrats, I think there's a certain point when a market has become so corrupt that it can't be saved, and healthcare in this country has become one of those.
Corrupt in what way?
In the way that we've looked at healthcare and criminal justice, but specifically with healthcare as profit centers. People's health should not be something that's traded back and forth on a budget statement. You know, and truthfully, the way we've made healthcare and health insurance profitable in this country is a testament to how broken the system is, right? So everybody who thinks I should go to the doctor today sits there and has to debate whether or not they think the ROI in that doctor's visit is going to be worth it to them or not, and has to think, okay, well, I have to spend $50 less at the food store for my kids today if I go to the doctor to, you know, get medication for my strep throat. And that's not the way it should be. Folks should feel comfortable going to the hospital and getting the care that they need, not only because it's better for them in the short term, but because it prevents more long-term issues that are going to cost our economy and them as individuals more at the end of the day.
How much might American taxes have to go up to pay for this? I've seen estimates in the high billions and even trillions.
Oh, I think that those are both grossly overstated. I think that if we want to look at taxes going up 3 to 5%.
Or the cost. I shouldn't say taxes overall, but
yeah,
the cost of it.
I think we could make some great headway just by repealing the recent tax break that was given to corporations and multimillionaires as to taking on some of the costs of a single-payer healthcare solution. I also think that, as a nation, all of us are, for the most part, not healthcare experts, and a lot of folks don't realize that while we don't have a national healthcare program today, that hospitals don't refuse service to anybody seeking it. So in actuality, if somebody goes into a hospital and seeks help for a car accident or what have you, and they don't have healthcare, we're subsidizing that cost through what we're paying. So if your healthcare bills are, $800 a week, perhaps they would be $700 a week if the hospital didn't have to factor in the fact that 20% of people who go in can't afford it. So they're passing that cost along to us one way or another. I'd rather do it in an organized fashion where we can say, hey, from now on, instead of just guessing how many people aren't going to be able to afford it and moving the cost around to balance the numbers, let's find a way to actually provide them health care so we don't run into that.
A couple last questions for you, Mr. Cardinal. The current member of Congress for the 1st District, Carol Shea Porter, backed an earlier Democratic effort to impeach President Trump, and she recently called for him to step down or be impeached after his comments at the Russian summit in Helsinki. Do you agree with Congresswoman Carol Shea Porter on this, Mr. Cardinal?
I agree that Donald Trump is not the most representative person of the United States of America. I think that we've made a mistake as Democrats and as undeclareds over the past 2 years of equating everything that President Trump does with his voters and his base, and I think it's a shameful mistake. I know a lot of folks who have been Republicans their whole lives who are good, decent people who actually agree with a lot of a progressive message. It's just the way we're articulating isn't correct. I think that the way he acted with Russia recently was shameful. I think that many of the things he does personally are embarrassing and less than what America deserves. But I'm willing to wait till the end of the Mueller investigation to talk about impeachment. At that point, given the things that have started to leak already and what might come out of the investigation, I would support or not support impeachment based on that data rather than deciding before we have any of the results.
You've said that no one party is to blame for today's divisive climate. So as a Democrat, then, how has your party contributed to this climate that we're seeing today?
I think in many ways, I think that we spend so much time talking through narratives that drive us apart and pretending that these are issues that are important to the average American voter. Many of the things that both parties have pushed us into the corner with are issues that don't affect our day-to-day lives. If we spent more time focusing on the programs that people agree on, that they should have quality health care, that working a 40-hour week should get you enough to live in decency and be able to provide for yourself and your family, that we'd have a much more unified country. I have a lot of Republican family and friends, and we spent many a meal or a drink over the past 2 years talking about how we know we're not enemies. We all love each other. We've all gotten along for years, and all of a sudden, here we are.
Well, Mr. Cardinal, I'll have to wrap it up there. I really appreciate you coming in.
Well, thank you so much for having me and for putting all this together and for having all the candidates. It's great that we've all been able to get our voice out.
Well, it has been great. And if anybody wants to listen or watch, you can check out our Facebook page or go to nhpr.org/exchange.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.